Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan officially became a right-to-work state today, the 24th in the nation, second in the Midwest. On our show today, we find out just what Michiganders think of this new controversial law. And a group of Republicans in Michigan are calling on Republican National Committeeman Dave Ajema to resign. We're going to find out about his controversial post on Facebook. But first, earlier this week on Stateside, we spoke with Todd Spangler. He's the D.C.-based reporter for the Detroit Free Press. We had him on the show to talk about the effects of the sequester on Michigan. The problem is, it's still really hard to figure out just what those effects are. Here's Todd Spangler.
When sequestration went into effect, and the way it was planned, it was an across-the-board cut. Different percentages for different agencies, but it was an across-the-board cut. And agencies really were supposed to just lop off things, if programs that were there. By going back into it as part of this Budget Appropriation Act from last week, Congress was able to move some money around, say, spend on this, but don't spend on that. So there has been some refinement, some parts of the sequester that they've been able to sort of tamp down. Whereas other things, you know, like TSA, is still going to take a cut.
So it seems it's kind of slippery. Some serious budget confusion appears to be the case. And whether or not we see drastic cuts in some departments and smaller cuts in others, no matter what, state budgets are going to be affected. Joining us now is the budget director for the state of Michigan, John Nixon. Director Nixon, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, it's great to be on.
So you heard Todd Spangler, who is a very smart, plugged-in reporter, going, you know, we're still not quite certain, even after nearly a month of the sequester, how it's all going to affect things. Is that your perspective as someone who clearly has to closely watch the federal budget?
Yeah, that's, you know, we are getting more information from the federal government. I mean, part of the thing is the federal government isn't really good at cutting budgets. And so there is a lot of kind of questioning going on out there. What applies, what doesn't apply? And really what we've got is we've got so many touch points with the federal government through all our state agencies and at the local in the local governments here in Michigan that what we're trying to do is work with them through their federal partners to get the impacts of where the cuts are coming and how they're coming. So it's not like one central notification from the federal government on how it's being done. We're actually relying upon all the different federal agencies and all the different federal touch points. So we have done some preliminary analysis, and we've gotten some feedback from our agencies, and I think we've got, you know, a pretty good idea with what's going to happen and how it's going to happen at this point. But again, I was talking with one of our big federal agencies just yesterday, and he said, I got an email from the federal government that said, good news. And then they went on, and he said it was awfully confusing. I don't know whether they were reinstating the cuts or whether, you know, but he said, I've got to follow up on it. So there is a lot of confusion going on right now.
It almost sounds kind of like that idea of herding cats, trying to figure out from so many areas and so many touch points just what is going to happen. But I guess what I'm hearing you say is that's why we were told, as the debate was going on about the sequester, it isn't like we're all going to wake up the morning after and everything's going to change.
That's right. That's right. I mean, you know, there were a couple of dates, and now the continuing resolution, you know, is expiring, and they've reauthorized the budget. And where have they reauthorized it? Have they moved money around? It looks like they have in some areas. So it's certainly an opportunity to really kind of stay busy and trying to figure it all out.
Well, knowing that President Obama has signed this short-term six-month plan, does that help you in planning Michigan's budget?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. You know, I always said going into sequestration that the uncertainty was what was really giving us a headache and causing us problems within our state budgets. But now that we know that it's there and as the amounts are becoming more clearly defined, it does help us with planning.
We're speaking with the budget director for the state of Michigan, John Nixon. And now, as you say, that it's we know the $85 billion in those across-the-board spending cuts are going to happen. What do you feel from where you sit, the question on so many minds of those of us living in Michigan, how do you feel that these budget cuts are going to affect life in Michigan?
You know what, to be honest with you, I think it depends. I mean, if you're a person who is being benefited or participating in the federal program, you might feel a pinch. I think for the vast majority of Michiganders, they won't really notice, to be honest with you. I mean, it is a lot of money. I mean, I think we're looking at maybe $150 million across the state through sequestration. And that I would never say that's an insignificant amount of money. But when you look at our economy, I think the average Michigander probably won't feel a whole lot. unless you're participating or working with a federal program that's being reduced. A lot of these reductions, and they're not immediate. You know, a good chunk of the reductions are happening in the education system at the local level, but the federal government's actually delayed those the implementation of those reductions till after the school year, so it won't take effect until next school year. And I think there's even thought that they may have an opportunity to reinstate those or work with those. And so, you know, at this point, I don't even know that the full $85 billion is going to happen. But the way that it's being done, and the federal government is trying to mitigate the impact, you know, on the pass-through to the clients and the people that we serve, and so is the state. So, you know, at the end of the day, while it's, you know, if you're benefiting from the program, you might feel it, but I don't think the general person in Michigan is going to really feel a pinch. You know, part of the big piece, one of the big pieces with sequestration is the military reductions. You know, we're not as heavily reliant upon the military industry as part of our economy as like a Virginia or a Maryland, you know, and so where we'll have an impact there, that's really the touch point that would hit your broader economy. And I wouldn't say we're immune from that, but we have less vulnerability there.
John, I can only assume that you are in contact with other budget directors from other states. What is kind of the talk amongst you and your peers about what's coming and about the fact that this does seem to be very fluid, which I can imagine makes trying to plan just a little more challenging?
Well, the talk with the budget directors, and I will tell you, it's been a while since I've been with them, but I do talk to them, you know, individually here and there, but the last meeting we got together was a pretty broad consensus that the biggest risk to their states and our state budgets was the federal government. You had the debt ceiling crisis looming. You had the fiscal cliff. We went through sequestration. And really that uncertainty with how it might or could have impacted our budgets, you know, we were carrying the federal government as one of our biggest risks to the current status of our state budgets. So I think as these decisions have been made at the federal level, I think it's helped ease the stress level. But, you know, we're not out of the woods either. I mean, we know that there's a lot to be debated. We, you know, it's kind of tough when you haven't passed a budget for so long at the federal level and you've been working on continuing resolutions. You know, that kind of makes long-term planning difficult. And the federal government's a big player in the states. And, you know, 40% of our revenue in Michigan comes from the federal government. So, you know, it does weigh on us pretty heavily. But I think the general consensus among the state budget directors was, you know, the federal government and Congress sets spending priorities and we'll run the programs within those the amount of money they send us in the best way we can.
John Nixon is Michigan's budget director. John, thanks for taking time to talk with us today on Stateside.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you.
So as we just heard, the average Michigander is probably not going to feel the impact of the sequester in our daily lives anytime soon. But as the weather starts to warm and we start making our summer vacation plans, visiting Michigan's largest attractions like the Sleeping Bear Dunes, that comes to mind. Well, now the dunes, along with other national parks across the U.S., are starting to feel the sequester squeeze. Tom Ulrich is the deputy superintendent of the Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore.
Well, we were directed to not furlough any of our year-round employees, although other agencies may be doing that. But since the national parks have a number of summer staff, seasonal employees, we are directed to take the cuts from that payroll. Unfortunately, our summer staff are the ones that really are where the rubber meets the road when it comes to visitor services and resource protection. So the sequester cuts will result in things that the visitor will see when they come to Sleeping Bear Dunes.
Such as?
Well, the Pierce Stocking Scenic Drive, one of our most popular attractions, where the only spot you can actually drive up to the top of the dunes and get that stupendous view out over Lake Michigan, that won't be open until Memorial Day weekend, and it will have to close on Labor Day weekend. Normally, it opens in April sometime and extends on into the fall, well into October. But I don't have the staff to open it, clear trees, sweep the drive, clean the restrooms, put in the boardwalk, et cetera. Another thing that visitors will notice is our restrooms and trash services at all of our beaches also will be reduced to only Memorial Day to Labor Day, whereas those two usually go mid-April, well into the fall. So those are things that even the casual visitor, when they come here, will be disappointed when they when they need the restroom services or want to go on the scenic drive.
I'm interested, Tom, because there's certainly lots of impact with your operation at Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore. Did you fare better than other parks throughout Michigan or throughout the country?
No, because the sequestration is such an across-the-board cut for all federal agencies, all national parks, anyway, had to absorb the same 5% cut. Now, state parks, of course, are not funded with the federal funding, so they aren't affected in the same way.
Okay. But National Lakeshore. Tom Ulrich, Deputy Superintendent at the Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore, taking a hit from the federal budget cuts thanks to the sequester. Thanks for talking with us, Tom.
Thanks, Cynthia.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, you won't get too much argument with the statement that the subject of Belle Isle's been the source of countless headlines in the past year or so, and most of them pretty contentious. The issue of whether or not the state would take over the running of Belle Isle and the cleanup of what was once a beautiful urban park was tossed back and forth between the Detroit City Council and Lansing like the proverbial hot potato. It finally ground to a halt when City Council dragged its collective foot for so long that Governor Snyder declared, time up, game over. The state took its offer off the table, saying there just wasn't enough time to get Belle Isle ready for the summer season. But this political squabbling over Belle Isle has a very long history in Detroit. It's nothing new. It goes right back to the very first thought that the Detroiters wanted a park. That was in 1871, and wait till you hear about the fireworks that ensued. Amy Elliott Bragg's the author of Hidden History of Detroit, and she blogs about Detroit history at nighttraintodetroit.com. Amy Elliott Bragg joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So why did you feel that your duty to go back there to 1871 and start digging into the history of the purchase of Belle Isle?
Well, if you read any history from the 19th century, which are my favorite history books about Detroit, it was such a big problem in Detroit, this idea of the park question and the conflict over the park question, that history writers almost glanced over it without getting into it. They would say, 1871, you all remember the park question. What a nightmare. Let's not revisit that history. Moving on. We got Belle Isle and it was great. And when I started to dig into the park question a little bit, I saw that it was a conflict over municipal bonds, and I got bored and I skipped it.
What a nightmare. Let's move
right?
on.
What a nightmare. Let's move on. Let's just skip right ahead to when it was a beautiful gem of an urban park. So when Belle Isle was so much a part of the news, starting, like you said, over a year ago, I started to think, is it time to revisit the park question? Do I need to know what happened? And when the park deal was on the table, I just thought, I have to get into this and find out what happened, because it's killing me to not know.
All right, so we want to kind of go back. We're going to go back to the purchase. But first of all, talk about the history that Belle Isle had. We've heard that the French settlers called it Île aux Cochons, Hog Island. It sounds much prettier in French.
Hog Island.
Hog Island. So how much controversy was stirred up by this idea of, hey, we want a park and we don't want a little bitty neighborhood park in 1871?
Right. There was a movement in Detroit to get a rural or sort of beautiful park. It was part of this sort of city beautiful movement that was happening in big urban centers all across the country. People wanted large parks, Central Park style parks, big boulevards with beautifully landscaped medians.
Grant Park in Chicago.
Exactly. Yeah. So the idea was not controversial to have this park. People wanted this park. The problem really started when people started to propose where the park was going to be. So the city council appointed a committee. They were called the Park Board, and they were set to the task of finding the spot for the park. And they settled on this parcel that was actually across the river from where Belle Isle is now, kind of that river frontage along Jefferson Avenue.
Sure, sure.
And that was part of the city of Hamtramck at the time. There was a little bit of controversy over that parcel. People thought, oh my gosh, it's so far east.
Who'll go there?
Who will go that far east? Of course, there were members of the park board who wanted the park to be closer to their houses. maybe they also had some land in the center of the city that the
somebody
city
could get
might
rich.
Be interested in purchasing.
Sure.
But they settled on this parcel after a tiny bit of controversy. The conflict really erupted when it became the city council's job to get a kind of a public accord on the land. Would the people of Detroit agree that this was the place for a park? And there wasn't really a good mechanism in place for gauging that public opinion. So what the mayor at the time said was, we'll have a citizens' meeting. And, you know, you can think even of citizens' meetings today. Who's going to show up? 10 people, 15 people, the most vocal members of our community.
The ones who want to really express in strong terms what they think.
Well, the mayor guessed a little bit wrong about the level of public interest in the park, and hundreds of people showed up for this citizens' meeting. And the mayor said, well, I will just have everybody gather in front of City Hall, in front on the lawn. I will stand from my window and look down at the crowd. And he said, okay, everybody who's in favor of this park, stand on one side. Everyone who's on the other side of this issue, stand on the other side of City Hall.
Okay.
But there was chaos. People didn't know what to do.
Which is left, which is right.
it's the 1870s, so there's no amplification system in place. I'm sure there's a lot of shouting and rabble. Mm. And the mayor just looks out the window and he says, I don't know, it kind of looks like everybody's standing over there. I guess they don't want to park. So there was also the issue of the fact that this is before the Home Rule Act. And everything that happens at the city level has to go through the state legislature.
Oh, great. So then you factor in Lansing to the chaos that's happening in Detroit.
You have people out, you know, the idea of a park seems really self-evident to us now. Like, why wouldn't you want a beautiful park where your kids can play, you can run with your dog, you can walk in the woods? But you have to imagine how different it was to have this urban center in Michigan. And if you have state legislators coming in from all over the state saying, what do you need a park for? What is that? You know, people who live on big farms or out in the country, they go, we're going to spend money on a park. You're just going to have some land that is there for people to what, walk around in? I don't understand. If people want to live in a filthy city, they live in a filthy city. That's not our problem.
Well, it came down to this thing that looked like a complete war of vetoes between Common Council and the mayor.
Absolutely. Well, you had a new mayor. So the guy who stood at his window and said, who's standing on what side of the city hall? That guy is voted out of office. You get a new mayor who comes in who is very anti-park. There's this thing called the Committee of 20, and they are mostly comprised of rich and influential people in the city of Detroit. Captain Eber Brock Ward was at the time one of the richest men in Michigan, and Eber Brock Ward is kind of heading up this committee, and he says, we don't want a park. We're going to stir up everyone in Detroit, get them all riled up about this issue of the park, maybe make a controversy out of something that's not so controversial to begin with.
To kill the idea.
To kill the idea. They said, we don't want to spend our taxes on this. The same issues came up as had come up in the first park board, where they said, maybe we want people to buy our land. Maybe we want people to have a park closer to our house. So the Committee of 20 also includes the mayor of Detroit. His name is Hugh Moffat, and Hugh Moffat doesn't want a park either. So you have the park board coming to the Common Council and saying, we need you to approve this bond. By this time, the parcel that they had selected was about to expire. They couldn't purchase it after a certain term had passed. And they said, we really need to purchase this land. The Common Council says no. Finally, the Common Council says okay, and they pass the bond resolution to the mayor. He vetoes it. The council actually overrides the veto and sends it back to the mayor. The bonds are actually on the mayor's desk, and the mayor refuses to sign them.
Wow. So he totally stole. So it looked like it was dead.
It looked like it was
dead. By 1874, but not so fast. And just in case you're joining us in our history lesson here, I'm talking with writer Amy Elliott Bragg, who wrote The Hidden History of Detroit and has done a very deep dive into all the shenanigans involved with the purchase of Belle Isle. So in 1879, here it comes again.
It rises from the ashes. So there had been talk of building a railroad bridge. And this actually originally came up in 1874, right after the park question had died. There was a lot of urgency around this idea of a railroad bridge. People said, we need to build it right now. If we don't, the city will fall to pieces. But of course, there's arguing about where the railroad bridge is going to go. Finally, someone says, I have this interesting idea. What if we build a railroad bridge across the river to Canada and we route it over Belle Isle? So we make a stop on Belle Isle. I don't know enough about infrastructure to know if this is actually going to work or if it makes the railroad track easier to build or what. But somebody says, you know, that's an interesting idea. We already had this fight about Belle Isle when we thought we would make it a park. Somebody eventually says, you know, we could buy it. It could be a park, and then we would just have it in case we also want to build a railroad bridge.
Somebody who clearly remembered the big park fight and still wanted a park.
Well, nobody wanted to relive the park fight. That was such a
bruising
battle among the public. So in 1879, it comes up in legislation in Lansing, and it passes. It passes very quickly. There's suddenly this public support for the idea that there hadn't been before. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that influential people who had some money who were fighting over it before said, okay, a railroad bridge, that we can get
that behind. We can get rich off of.
There's something in that for us.
There you go.
So the purchase goes through, and it only takes a couple of months to go from Lansing back to the council. The mayor, they luck out, and they have a mayor at the time who's behind the idea. He signs off on it, and by April of 1879, the Belle Isle deal is ready to go.
And it happened. I'm wondering in what you've discovered about, and there's even more. You really have to read what Amy's put together about the ins and outs and the fighting and the editorials and the name-calling. What can we in 2013 learn about what it took to make Belle Isle a city park? I know you wrote something about it's hard, loud, fighting work to make a city.
That's essentially what I came away from all of this research feeling. And, you know, back to the railroad bridge question, there was this great quote by Clarence Burton, a city historian at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to shuffle my papers here. He said of the railroad bridge, Clarence Burton wrote, "The matter did not take shape, though it was supposed the city would fall into immediate ruin unless the tunnel was built instantly." And I feel like that is part of the tenor of our conversations today. When the state park deal was on the table, people were saying, we have to do this. We have to do this now. We have to do this instantly. And if we don't, we are screwing it up for the rest of time. And I felt what Clarence Burton wrote resonated with me. I thought, you know, whatever you feel about Belle Isle's future, whatever you feel about the park deal, if you think it's a good idea, if you think it's a bad idea, like this urgency in some ways is unrealistic when you look at the fact that it took over 10 years because there was fighting after the purchase in 1879. People said, we want to sell it back. We don't want it to be a park. Get rid of it. There was an argument over the committee that would run the park, and there was this just ridiculous fight about it. And, you know, it was almost the 1890s when finally the park plan started to unfold the way it was supposed to. So, you know, I think we need some perspective sometimes when we're looking at these arguments. The news cycle is so fast, we say, you know, if we can't get any traction on this now, what if we never, ever will?
And it feels sometimes like all there ever is dissension and argument. But I guess the lesson of history is that's how you run things. That I love your line that there may be no right answer, that it's more important to build consensus for a workable solution than to pursue the perfect fix.
And, you know, that's the reality when there's something this large at stake. You know, Belle Isle has played a really large part in the city's history for a very long time. And we're not going to resolve what to do with it overnight. And we shouldn't, because it's really important. So we have to take time and fight over it a little bit for a while.
I try not to take things too personally, right?
Probably.
Amy Elliott Bragg is the author of Hidden History of Detroit, and she blogs about Detroit history. You can find that at nighttraintodetroit.com. Interesting history. Thanks for making it come to life for
us. Thank you so much for having me.
Be there and be square. That's the battle cry for tonight's first ever Nerd Night. It's happening tonight at Great Lakes Coffee on Woodward in the Medical Center area of Detroit. Having a Nerd Night in the 313 brings Detroit into the Nerd Night fold, as it were. Ann Arbor started its monthly Nerd Nights earlier this year. What is a Nerd Night, you ask? Well, I am glad you asked. We have organizers Liz Lamasti and Amber Conville join me in the studio now. So, Liz, I want to start with you. What happens during a Nerd Night?
A lot of things happen during a Nerd Night. So the basic idea is that we find three presenters from different disciplines. It can be anything from history to science to policy, anything is fair game. And they talk about whatever they're passionate about and what they think is interesting. And the audience drinks along and asks questions. And then during the transition, people make friends and talk about what they've heard.
So, Liz, give us an idea. Where did Nerd Night begin? I love the name, but the origin has to be really interesting.
It is really interesting. So it all began with this guy named Chris. And he was getting his PhD in evolutionary biology, chugging along, researching, which I'm sure a lot of our audience can relate to.
And where was Chris, by the way?
Chris was in Boston.
Okay.
So he went to Cameroon to do research on this bird. He thought the bird was really nice at first, and apparently it wasn't. It was this parasitic, angry, mean bird in Cameroon. And when he came back to Boston to talk about his research and move forward, he would talk about his story in a bar that he went to all the time. And at some point, the bartender, very understanding person, goes, "That's enough.
Enough with the gross bird.
Just bring everybody in, all of your friends. Bring them all in and talk about it and get it over with." So that happened. And then Chris talked to this guy named Matt, who was hosting trivia in New York. And they got to talking and saying, "We have something bigger here than me just talking about my dissertation project." And thus, Nerd Night was born. This is about the mid-2000s or so.
Okay.
And so we have one in Boston, New York, and then they started spreading in the East Coast all the way to Wellington, Windsor, Portland, now Ann Arbor and Detroit. So it's pretty hard to travel in the United States and not find one.
Is it pretty much a college student thing, or is it open to all comers?
It's open to all comers, and actually, in our experience in Ann Arbor, we didn't do any formal data or anything, but it seemed a good mix of people who were professionals working and students. So it's good to be in university towns because it's easy to find presenters.
A lot of nerds.
Lots of nerds. But in Detroit, none of our presenters are in school right now. So it's a mix.
So for tonight's inaugural Nerd Night in Detroit, Anne Burkhondo, give us an idea of... you've got three presenters lined up. Who's going to be speaking and what are they going to speak about?
So up first, we have Misha Adams and Matt Buss, who own the Detroit Fly House, which is a circus school in Detroit. They are coming to talk about running a circus school and what that entails and how much fun it is.
Who knew? I didn't know there was a circus school in Detroit. Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. It's actually really fun. I've been myself a number of times.
Okay.
Then we're going to have Amy Elliott Bragg from the Detroit Drunken Historical Society. She's coming to talk about the pre-Purple Gang prohibition in Detroit. And then we also have Charles Gibson from the Michigan Science Center coming to talk about spiders. His talk is actually called Arachnoholics Anonymous. He was originally afraid of them and then started studying them more. And now there's pictures of him with spiders on his face.
Wow. It certainly, Nerd Night seems to be about fun and about entertainment. But what do you think it says about adding that entertainment value to learning? How does that impact what people remember and what they think about what they're learning?
That's a really good question. I think in addition to just learning something new about the subject matter, if people leave with a new interest, or they might be motivated to dig into a topic they've been thinking about that didn't come up in Nerd Night, and maybe they'll want to present in the future, or they'll want to tell their friends about it, or start another group or something like that. So I think it's not just about the entertainment, and it's not just about the learning for learning, which is valuable, and we think that information exchange is really important. Mm. But it's also sort of what we can do together that we probably wouldn't do so much on our own.
That's pretty fun. And as you say, it's open to all comers, so you don't have to feel that you don't have to be a college student or even a member of a university community to get something out of Nerd Night. Liz Lamasti and Amber Conville are the organizers of the inaugural Nerd Night in Detroit, Nerd Night in the 313. As they say, Nerd Night is like the Discovery Channel with beer. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan became the nation's 24th right-to-work state, the second in the Midwest after Indiana. That law, of course, was passed with much controversy and thousands of angry demonstrators packing in and around the state capitol last December. Well, a new poll out today shows that Michiganders are deeply divided over this new law. Michigan State University's State of the State survey asked more than 1,000 people whether they thought right-to-work would be good for Michigan's economy. Charlie Ballard, economist at Michigan State University, directs the survey, a frequent guest on Stateside, and he joins us now from East Lansing. Welcome back, Charlie.
Thanks very much. Glad to be on the program.
So fill us in. What do the percentages look like in terms of those who support right to work and those who don't feel it's a good thing for Michigan?
Well, we asked people their opinion about how it would help or hurt the economy. And we gave them five choices: help a lot, help a little, no effect, hurt a little, or hurt a lot. Well, it's pretty darn evenly divided. If you add up the help a lot and help a little, those come to 42.7% who think that they will help, that right to work will help the economy at least some.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the other side, 41% believe it'll hurt. And with the size of our sample, those two are, you can't tell them apart. That is, statistically, that is a dead heat.
Wow.
Basically, it pretty much breaks right down the middle. And one out of six, 16%, said that they thought it would have no effect whatsoever. So the opinions are divided all over the place, but they're divided pretty evenly.
So amongst the 42% saying it would be good and 41% saying bad, how does it break down demographically? Is there kind of a trend of that you could put your finger on with each group?
Well, a lot of these break down in ways that I think are not all that surprising, because you see the same thing in exit polls from the presidential election and so on. Republicans are much more favorable toward right to work than Democrats. Conservatives like it a lot more than liberals. There is something of a divide between regions of the state, with West Michigan, the Grand Rapids area, being much more favorable than Southeast Lower Michigan. Men are more favorable than women toward right to work, and whites believe that right to work will be helpful for the economy much more than blacks. And many of those are the same kinds of breakdowns that you would probably expect to see in regarding a lot of other issues.
You also asked about Governor Rick Snyder. How is Governor Snyder faring in Michigan residents' minds?
Well, he's sort of hanging in there. His ratings have been pretty close to unchanged for the last year or so. He's at about 34% who give him either an excellent or a good rating. He's been in the mid-30s for the last year or more, pretty much unchanged. Maybe not surprisingly, those who think right to work is a good idea are much more likely to give high marks to the governor than those who think that right to work will hurt the economy.
Now, you were asking these questions, Charlie, when? What was the time span?
We began in January, and we just finished up in early March a couple of weeks ago, and then it took us a while to wait and code the data and all that. These are fairly recent.
Yeah, so this has all been since the right to work lame duck, you know, tensions of last December, and also since the new emergency manager law got written and put into place in January and taking effect today as well. So
exactly,
he actually kind of did better than maybe some people might have thought.
Well, you know, my sense of it is that the folks who thought that right to work was a good idea, they were already giving him higher marks.
Mm-hmm.
And the folks who thought that right to work was not a good idea were already giving him lower marks. And so those things didn't change over time. And so Governor Snyder's ratings did not change very much over time. That's my sense of what happened.
Were any of these results super surprising to you?
Let me see. Not a whole lot. Although, here's an interesting one. Some of the folks who I would have expected, some groups that I would have expected to be even more adamant on one side or the other, still had substantial numbers who, substantial disagreement. For instance, among people who call themselves very conservative, I would have expected overwhelming support for right to work. Well,
yeah.
63% did say that they think it'll help, but 26% said that they thought it would hurt.
Hmm.
So it's not perhaps as cut and dried as I would have thought. I mean, in a survey like this, you always get at least some variation. But to say that you're very conservative is not identical to saying that you're a strong supporter of right to work. And also among the very liberal, yes, 77% said they thought it would hurt the economy, but 11% of very liberal Michigan residents said they believe that right to work will help.
Hmm. So as an economist, Charlie, what do you take away from these results?
Well, as an economist, of course, I study these not just from the perspective of the public opinion survey, but also my own reading of the literature. Actually, I think that a lot of folks have it pretty close. If you were to ask me as an economist what effect it would have, probably fairly modest. And a big reason for that is that unions have already lost so much strength. In the 60s, 45% of Michigan workers were union members. Now it's 17 or 18%. So, and it's only 11% among the private sector workers. So it's not like things were going well for unions and then all of a sudden out of nowhere comes right to work. Rather, right to work is sort of the culmination of a very long period of relative decline. And since most folks already are not a member of a union, I think that the effects are likely to be relatively small. Plus, there's so much else going on in determining where companies hire people. After all, in Michigan, we have way too many people who are high school dropouts. Well, before right to work, those people are going to have trouble finding any job. And if they can find a job, it's not going to be a great one.
Mm.
Well, you bring in right to work, they're still going to have trouble finding any job. And if they do find a job, it's not going to be a great one. So there's so many other things. And so when I see a lot of people saying they think it'll have no effect or little effect, that sort of jibes with my sense as an economist.
Speaking as an economist, and he is our official stateside economist, Charlie Ballard, director of the State of the State Survey at Michigan State University. Thanks for talking with us today, Charlie.
Thank you, Cindy.
A group of Michigan Republicans is up in arms today over a Facebook post made by one of their party. Republican National Committee man and former Michigan legislator David Ajima put a post on his Facebook page yesterday. It was based on an article that appeared under the byline of Frank Joseph, M.D. Among other things, the article claims that gays were responsible for half the murders in our large cities, and it portrays gays as sexually promiscuous, spreading sexually transmitted diseases, and trying to get the public to, quote, affirm their filthy lifestyle, close quote. Well, now, 21 Republican precinct delegates and young Republican leaders in Michigan are calling on Ajima to resign, and his response, absolutely not. Joining me from the studio is one of those 21 critics. We have Dennis Lennox, who's a Republican precinct delegate from Grand Traverse County. Thanks for coming into the studio, Dennis.
Good afternoon.
So this Facebook post comes on the day of the Supreme Court oral arguments on the legality of same-sex marriage. What did you think when you first laid eyes on it?
You know, without getting into values and beliefs, because the people that have signed this reign, you know, the entire Republican spectrum, I just think it's reprehensible. It's deplorable. It can't be defended. I don't even want to repeat some of the things that have been said. You know, legitimate people can disagree on some of the great issues of the day that have been debated and discussed this week. But this goes well beyond civil discourse. It's offensive. And quite frankly, for a political party that's lost 5 out of the last 6 presidential elections in terms of the popular vote, you're spitting in the face of people whose votes you need.
And that's really been the big message about the GOP ever since last November is we've got to open up. That's what we're seeing is younger Republicans like.
Well, absolutely. I'm 28. Mm-hmm. I'm a young Republican. And with all due respect to Mr. Ajima and some of the old guard in the party, I don't think they necessarily care what the party's going to be like in 15 or 20 years or even if it's relevant, let alone 5 years from now. My generation.
Why?
Well, you know, their time has come and went. Mr. Ajima has been elected 3 times to the legislature. He's probably not going to run for political office again. My generation is going to be around for 20 or 30 years. And my Republican Party certainly can't afford to write off the second largest voting demographic, young leaders who find what was said. And I would hope just not young people. I think most civil, sensible folks, Republican, Democrat, Independent, found what he said to be reprehensible. But particularly my generation, and again, not getting into values and beliefs and principles, it was just reprehensible. It was deplorable. And he should do the right thing and resign.
And you pulled together with 20 others, so that was a pretty quick response, wasn't
it? Was,
it?
And actually, since we put the resignation out last night, we're at over 50 now,
okay.
Several county Republican Party chairmen. We've had other senior leaders behind the scenes have said that they're doing things behind the scenes. I wish they would step forward publicly. I don't understand why some people aren't afraid to get out in front of this. And I think it's disgusting, his response, that his justification was he, quote unquote, didn't say this. He just posted it.
Copied and pasted.
And I mean, somebody that was in the legislature, somebody that's on the Republican National Committee, he should and does know better.
All right. We know that David Ajima has a track record of inflammatory statements and posts. He has long opposed the idea that gay people have any rights at all. He was the one during the right to work demonstrations last December when the tear gassing of demonstrators was going on. He posted, "I rather enjoy this," saying it reminded him of being back in the military. So why was it that he was chosen to be one of Michigan's two representatives to the Republican National Committee?
Well, he was elected at a state convention last spring. In fact, many of the people that signed the letter were people that supported him in that race and voted for him. He's lost supporters based on what he has said. In fact, actually, in the last 24 hours now, I haven't been contacted by anyone of any position or prominence that actually supports what he said, except for himself. And I think he should do the right thing. I think it's just not me. I think he should listen to the leaders from across the state who have said, you need to resign. And instead, he is digging in and trying to defend and explain this away. This can't be defended or explained. It's reprehensible. Again, I'm not even comfortable repeating some of the things that he leveled.
Let me just say, because this is not a new thing. So he's got a long track record. Why, when you say he was elected, why wasn't that basically kind of giving a blessing to his views?
Well, I can't really speak to what he did before he was elected. I can say since he took his position on the Republican National Committee, he certainly has said some things that I don't think, because of that, this was a total surprise. Some people started rolling their eyes a long time ago with Mr. Ajima. But again, he was elected by a majority of the delegates at a statewide convention. And as one of those delegates and as the other delegates have said, we're not going to accept this. And the Republican leadership can do what they want. But we as delegates are going to stay strong and stay united on this and say this isn't our party. He doesn't speak for our party. And shame on him.
There is that that perception, if you will, of the GOP as the Republican, the party of the comfortable old white guys. How does that differ from what you see as your GOP?
Well, it is a problem. I mean, listen, the Republican Party has lost five of the last six presidential elections. There's no ifs, ands, or buts that the Republican Party needs to look and talk like the America of the second decade of the 21st century. I'm 28. When I first got involved in politics 10 years ago, working for the reelection campaign of President Bush at 18, I was the youngest face in the room. Today, I'm still the youngest face in the room outside of kind of the Lansing, Washington Beltway crowd. Something's wrong. And if people aren't realizing that, certainly I think these comments are a wake-up call that the party needs to change, that Mr. Ajima's generation has had their time, it's come and went, and it's now time for a new generation of leaders at all levels, both in terms of party positions and the candidates that we're putting forward. They have to look and talk like the America and the Michigan of the second decade of the 21st century so we can start winning elections again.
What do you believe, based on your deep involvement in the Republican Party, what does it offer to you and to people that you want to attract to the Republican Party?
Well, I think
because when you look at this, that's not a very tasteful look at it.
Well, I don't think, and I shouldn't say I don't think. I know Mr. Ajima's sentiments are not representative of the Republican Party writ large, the party that I joined. I'm a Republican Party, member, first and foremost, because I'm a conservative. I believe the Republican Party is the natural home of people of conservative inclinations, both ideological and just generally inclined conservatives. But for me, I think the Republican Party's greatest message is it's the party of opportunity. Equal opportunity, not outcome, equal opportunity for all. It's always been the party about equal opportunity, about justice, you know, and the other party wants to guarantee outcomes. And you can't guarantee outcomes. And I think we in the Republican Party have to remember that we need the message of opportunity. And when we talk about the message of opportunity for all, we do win. It's when we get distracted. And this is a distraction that I don't think anyone wants to talk about. I wish we could be here talking about different things. Unfortunately, Mr. Ajima has forced young Republican leaders across the state to stand up, speak out and say, no, he doesn't speak for us.
Now, there will be people out there who will say, well, I too believe, as does Dave Ajima, that marriage should be between a man and a woman, And by the way, that First Amendment guarantees free speech, which he is exercising. And to that you say?
You know, this isn't about values. This isn't about deeply held convictions or principles. Nobody is advocating throwing aside timeless principles. This is about messaging. You can be a conservative and still have a relevant message. What he said isn't conservative. It's hateful. It's wrong. It's bigoted. And moreover, it's just plain stupid. You're trying to get votes of undecided voters, the type of people that you need to win a national majority, and he's spitting in their face and then asking for their vote and then wondering why they're not voting for him. That's a problem.
So where do you go from here? I know you say there are discussions, there are things going on, people that aren't stepping forward as publicly as you and the others. So what now?
Well, he needs to resign, and we're not going to stop until he resigns. He needs to do the right thing. Unfortunately, there doesn't appear to be a mechanism to remove him from his position, at least at the state level. There could be something, from what I understand, that the National Committee could refuse to seat him at a future meeting. But I don't believe, based on what I've looked at, we can remove him at the state level. I hope he will listen to the growing coalition of leaders, many of whom are his allies and supported him. And he would just step aside and do the right thing. This is a distraction. It's disgraceful. And this isn't the type of rhetoric that we need as Republicans going into a very critical 2014 election in Michigan.
Dennis Lennox is a Republican precinct delegate from Grand Traverse County. He and at least 20, and the number seems to be growing, Michigan Republicans calling for RNC committeeman David Ajima to resign after an anti-gay post on his Facebook page yesterday. Dennis, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much.
We contacted Committeeman Ajima's office today looking for a comment. He did not return our calls, but Ajima did release an email. The Detroit News reports the committeeman says, and I quote, "I copied and pasted a piece written by an author, Dr. Frank Joseph, onto Facebook, and some publications and even a few liberal Republicans have chosen to take the words of someone else and cast them as my own. I think it was a piece worth sharing given the debate over gay marriage that's happening in the Supreme Court. I strongly maintain my position in support of marriage as being between a man and a woman and will not back down from my core beliefs in support of strengthening the family." Again, the words of Dave Ajima. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer was Bob Scon. I am Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.